couple of things straight here. Everybody has these images of Peter Pan as either this, you know, if you're my age, 50s, there was in the 50s this Mary Martin amazing TV production based on the stage show. Or maybe you're thinking of the Disney film, which, you know, gets re-released every so often. But for more sophisticated readers, it's understood that there was a writer by the name of James M. Barry, a Scot, who wrote some very wonderful and very, very bizarre works. A number of plays that have been turned into many movies. The Admirable Crichton. He was... I don't know about how prolific he was. He had 10, 12 books easily. And any number of plays. But the thing that has outlived him, the thing that has become more famous than his own name, is the creation of what was originally a 3-year-old fairy imp in a story called The Little White Bird. That was a novel. And I mean, to call it psychedelic is merely to show some of its prescience of where things were going. Very strange, very bizarre, wonderful stuff. And this was written, published first, in 1902. And chapters, I'm cheating and looking at some information here. 13 through 18 of The Little White Bird were later published on their own under the title Peter Pan in Kensington Gardens, with illustrations by the great fantasy illustrator Arthur Rackham, whose name you may not know, but if you were to see the artwork, you would be familiar with it. You would say, oh, okay, that's what that is. In 1904, now a mere what, 107 years ago, J.M. Barrie took that character who was 3 years old in The Little White Bird and made him, what, I guess about 8. I mean, he's immortal. Peter Pan is immortal, but he's about 8 years old with all of the maturity and understanding that goes along with being 8 years old. And by the way, as a 3-year-old, I mean, he did, you know, bizarre and nasty little stuff. Peter Pan is an imp. Peter Pan is a fairy himself. Don't just think of Tinkerbell as a fairy. Peter himself is from the land of fairy, where is never land, but within that world itself. J.M. Barrie was following a tradition. So he wrote this play, Peter Pan, or The Boy Who Wouldn't Grow Up. It was not a musical, it was a play. It was made as a silent film, a very American silent film. There's a point where after Peter, I'm trying to remember the woman who played her, she was adorable, Betty something, at any rate. Peter Pan, at the end, yes, she's battling Captain Hook, and then when he's vanquished, she unfurls, not the Union Jack, as you would expect, but an American flag. Very interesting. I've never seen that whole movie. I would like to. As I said, it's a silent film, so not... I don't know if the entire thing exists, but enough of it exists that I've seen, you know, like 5-minute clips here and there, usually on Classic Arts Showcase or some wonderful show like that. Anyway, so you've got Little White Bird, then you've got Peter Pan, then The play was adapted and expanded as a novel in 1911 called Peter and Wendy, and has sometimes also been titled Peter Pan and Wendy, sometimes Peter Pan. This is all that one novel. That novel is sort of it's the Bible. It's the seminal thing. Everything else follows from that. There have been any number of musicals. One with music written by Leonard Bernstein, that was directed by Jerome Robbins. It didn't last long. There was the 1953 movie, the Disney thing, which of course did to Peter what Disney always does to people.
Colorizes and infantilizes.
Yeah. Very much so. Yeah, it infantilizes a lot of it, actually, but Peter was an infant. Peter was a baby to begin with. Yeah. He's 3 years old in the original story. He's three, and he steals babies from carriages in Kensington Gardens, actually joins them, and as you heard in the text, we opened with a little bit of Peter and Wendy from the forthcoming show by the Mabu Mines.
Jim, I liked something you said before about the wisdom of children.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that intelligence may be an exponential function with a negative coefficient.
Oh, okay. So we can actually reduce it now to numbers, in a way.
We hope to end up as smart as we started.
Yeah, yeah. And this is actually part of what J.M. Barrie says. And when you really read about the terror and the horror of children, but also the unbelievable, the concept behind Peter Pan, who has very good reasons for not growing up, because he may be in some ways a monster in some versions, but he's also a spirit and a very by the time we get to Peter and Wendy, by the time we get to the novel, then he's this very interesting character, very symbolic of many things. That novel itself, I'm not sure of whether or not whoever else has done productions.
Jim, I've got to ask you. There's an obscure movie about a girl who had an invisible friend who wore a plaid jacket and red hair.
Is that Drop Dead Fred
yes.
or something? Is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that in any way conceptually related to what you're talking about?
I would say so. Yeah. I would say so. Yeah. I don't think that it was a direct conscious
thing. No.
But I think that it comes from a similar place in storytelling.
Like a precious cavern of youthful consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll accept that. Absolutely, absolutely. And along with that, you get then the wonderful concept that J.M. Barrie had of the Lost Boys, which is what our show will be about, except we're not doing the Lost Boys.
You know what? I'm going to take a cab so I can be a book runner here. The Lost Boys.
Yes, but that's not what we're doing.
Oh.
We're doing the Lost Girls.
Well, screw it. I'll take it somewhere.
Pat Cadigan, who is one of the best writers of science fiction and fantasy about, wrote and performed a wonderful variation on the tale as told from the viewpoint of Tinkerbell. Now, don't think Tinkerbell is a nice... I mean, what is it Tinkerbell does in the story of Peter Pan? She gets jealous and wants to kill Wendy.
Tinkerbell was that guy who flopped around in the control tower in Airport. You know the guy?
I think so. But we're talking here about a sprite.
Yeah.
Okay. And Tinkerbell is very, very jealous of Wendy. And, well, this is in the story. And what does she do? She poisons Wendy. Remember, that is the premise of the story.
Yeah.
She poisons Wendy. Now, let's take that and tell it from the point of view of Tinkerbell as a murderer. And this is The Lost Girls. Only Pat Cadigan is a wonderful person, a wonderful writer as well. She is one of the first important writers of cyberpunk. that when people think of cyberpunk, everybody thinks of William Gibson, Bruce Sterling, John Shirley. Absolutely, John Shirley. Shirley, you're kidding. But let's add to that Pat Cadigan. She is a major force in that era when John Shirley and all these people came about. You've had Shirley on your show a few times, haven't you?
Yes, that's
right. And it's been a while since he's come to New York. It's been about 8 years or so. So, at least since I've seen him.
Right now. He'll be back, though.
Oh, yeah. So, Pat, this is 1993, setting our way back machine, wrote this amazing story called The Lost Girls, and we're going to hear that. We're going to hear that performance in just a couple of minutes.
Okay, then I'll take it above ground cap so I can hear it.
Ah, there you go.
All right.
There you go. There is an industry based on retellings and variations, themes and variations on Peter Pan. There's a play running right now. I don't even know what it is. And then there's a play being revived by the Mabu Mines called Peter and Wendy. Now, I've seen that twice. And I will be seeing it a third time when it reopens. It'll be at the New Victory Theater in about a month or so. The music that you heard is from that by Johnny Cunningham. And for those who know my musical tastes, you're probably well aware that this sort of fits into it all. So this has provided me with the excuse. There's this one woman. I have to show Robert the picture of this woman. This woman here, right above my thumb, the black woman in there, she does every voice in the show. She does everybody from Mr. Darling to Peter to Captain Hook.
I'm not allowed to express my reaction in the month of March.
Nah, but... and then everybody else are puppets. But she does every voice. This is... I mean, because it's a limited run, it isn't eligible for a Tony Award. Aww. But let me tell you, if it were... She wouldn't be nominated. Mm-hmm. She'd be the winner. Mm-hmm. This is an amazing performance. And if you like puppetry, and here's Peter on the cover. He's sort of a marionette.
Yeah.
But Nana is more.
Can you get me tickets?
I can't get myself tickets. I'm buying my tickets.
No, Broadway's a tough talk.
No. It's the New Victory Theater. Their most expensive seats are like $30.
Oh. All right.
Yeah, but actually, I may be able to get you tickets because I'm going to be producing an episode of Cat Radio Cafe for Janet, and it is my intention to have people from the Mabu Mines.
All right, we'll talk.
Long been associated with BAI. Remember Rick Harris.
Arts,
there's the Mabu Mines connection.
Drama and literature.
Yes.
And boy, was there much of one.
Yes. Yes, we had a lot of drama in that department. Good night. Take care. So I'm not just doing this to promote Peter and Wendy, although there is no good reason not to. I'm doing this because I love playing this reading by Pat Cadigan. And you know what? I think it's time to move on to that. Because that is sort of the center, the feature piece of this morning's show. I was going to tell a little bit more history. Let's see. There are Peter and the Star Catchers. Actually, I think that's... that might even be the show that's currently running off-Broadway. I would like to find out more about that before the show is over and see if I can tell you more. But, go to Wikipedia. I'm taking a look here. There's a tremendous amount, most of it accurate, of the history of Peter Pan. And it's not the little kid stuff that you would think. There's no question. I told you about The Little White Bird and Peter Pan in Kensington Gardens. When you read that, you know this stuff was not written for kids. Now, Peter and Wendy is family-friendly, the novel and the show. And the last time I saw it, I accompanied, or was accompanied by, I'm not sure which, a 7-year-old It's a full-length show, and never did her attention waver from the stage at one moment. It's just so compelling. The puppetry is absolute genius. The performance of this woman in the lead, Karen... Oh, I'm so ashamed. I actually have to look here at the copy. I can't believe they don't have her name. Oh, there it is. Karen Candle. K-A-N-D-E-L. Karen Candle, whose voice you heard at the very beginning, and we're going to hear a little bit more of that later. But it's the Mabu Minds production. It's the new Victory Theater. But, okay, now, let's change the setting. I was talking about Pat Cadigan. And at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings in 1993, I was not then the producer of the series, which I am now, but I have recorded the series from the very beginning, when it was first created by my guest of 2 weeks ago, Gordon Van Gelder. And, that reminds me, I really do need to promote the next reading. The next reading will be Tuesday, April 5th. April 5th. We will have two writers reading. Lev Grossman, author of The Magicians, book critic for Time magazine. He's a professional technology writer. He, in fact, wrote the article in Time magazine last year on the Man of the Year, who was Mark Zuckerberg, and then followed that up with the people who have written about Mark Zuckerberg, which is to say Aaron Sorkin and the people who made the movie The Social Network all about Mark Zuckerberg. And so he will be one of our readers, and Barbara Krasnoff, who people who listen to this program when it was on Saturdays 5 to 7 a.m. may have heard her read some of her fiction. She is a brand new story, and she is also a technology writer at Computer World magazine, and no novels out, but about 17 stories in print. Not currently in print, but 17 stories sold. His website is Lev Grossman, L-E-V-G-R-O-S-S-M-A-N, and her website is Brooklyn Writer. Both are .coms. And you can read work of both of those people on each of those websites. Okay, so that's April 5th. Admission is free. Donations accepted. At 138 Sullivan Street, the Soho Gallery for Digital Art. For more information, go to my website, ourwolf.com, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F, and look for the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings link, and that will give you the full schedule, including that one April 5th, and more information. And if you'd like to be on my mailing list, send me an email, jim@ourwolf.com. Again, H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F, like the name of the show. No small coincidence. Okay, so let's do a station break, and let's get on to the business of going to an older New York Review of Science Fiction reading. Horrified to see that this is 1993, 18 years ago, because I remember it. Not like it was 18 years ago, like it was recently. I can see Pat in my head reading it. And this is one of my favorite readings that we've ever had from that series. And, well, you will hear why. So, set your way back machine for 1993. Let me tell you that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org, stream.WBAI.org to hear it live, archive.WBAI.org to see what you've missed. You might have been asleep and missed a show. Such things happen. So you go to archive.wbai.org to hear what you missed. That way you won't miss nothing. Except, well, let's not go there. So, we have no introduction. Pat read two stories in the second half of that particular evening. And this was the second of the two stories that she read at the time. pardon me, I had lowered the volume on that media player so I could do a segue before. Let's try that again.
This next one that I'm going to read to you is called Lost Girls, and it's going to be the original story in my upcoming collection, Dirty Work, Lost Girls. Well, I tried to tell him there was going to be trouble. I really did. I really thought that as the female who'd been closest to him the longest, I'd have some major influence, that he would listen. But it's the same old story. It's just about impossible to get anyone to take you seriously when you're only a few inches high and covered with fairy dust. And you're cursed with tinkling bells for a voice. After that, the frivolous name is practically an anticlimax. Can't say I haven't contributed to my own predicament, though. For time out of mind, I played the role of the party girl with gusto. I mean, after all, I was the one who always got everybody high. Literally. If you wanted to fly, I was the girl to see. I had the stuff. Still am. You can't help what you are, after all. But, as I maintained to Peter, you can help what you do with it. We're doing just fine, Tink, he said, folding his arms behind his head and watching the clouds sail by. He was picking out shapes in them, ships, castles, dragons, two-headed teddy bears, the usual for around here. The clouds always do that, float across the sky in shapes you could pick out, except on the few occasions that call for a quirker of a thunderstorm. We're doing better than ever. We're giving all those boys and girls a childhood. Childhood's getting scarcer all the time. They have to start school now when they're practically out of their prams. They don't even have prams anymore, not the way we used to know them. And by the time I come to take them away on adventures, they can read and count and write, they can name the days of the week and the months of the year, and their heads are filled with the most peculiar notions. For instance, he said quickly, sitting up and letting a really good cloud that looked like a giant porcupine playing a pipe organ break up unnamed. For instance, that little one that kept trying to tell me the Indians weren't Indians, they were... He made a face. Couldn't remember, of course. Peter's memory is the size of a hazelnut, and not a very big hazelnut. But then, it has to be. He wouldn't be who and what he is if he had any kind of memory. He's the original lost boy, after all. And so he's perpetually at square one. Every hurt is like the first hurt, every joy like the first, and so on and so forth. But when the occasion called for it, he could summon up a little recollection about something extraordinarily bad, or extraordinarily good, or just extraordinarily extraordinary. This would stay with him for a little while until some other extraordinary thing came along to replace it. Native Americans, I said. I always remember. Being a fairy, my memory is not subject to the constraints of eternal childhood. Who are? He said. Indians, Peter. Indians. The little boy told you that Indians should really be called Native Americans. I wasn't impatient, just bored. Oh, yes. Native Americans. Indians. Heavens, Tink, what are Americans? The Indians are the Indians. They've always been the Indians. No use to explain to Peter about that, that the people he called Indians bore about as much resemblance to the real thing as I did. Some of them could have been Sioux or Comanche or Mohawk, but the rest of them were a mixture of nationalities and ethnic groups. Peter had a child's blindness to that kind of difference between people, endearing and beautiful in one way, totally insensitive in another. Gay, innocent, and heartless, remember? Tiger Lily and I had covered that subject a few times in the course of our many late-night talks. When Peter thought I was safely shut up in my little house within the house, I would fly off into the night, over the mountains and the valleys and the lagoon to her teepee. She was the only other female on the island who would understand. Yes, we set aside our differences a long, long time ago, though Peter doesn't know it. As the source of the problem, he just wouldn't get it. He'd feel betrayed, even though he never understood why we were in conflict in the first place, and never will. How's that for an obtuse male, I ask you? He's a child, Lil said, rolling her eyes. The idea that there'd be something about people that had nothing to do with him or his ideas just never occurs to him. If you try to tell him even just a little bit about what really happened to the people called Indians, well, it'd be like speaking high church Latin to him. He'd understand it about as well. He's got just enough information and misinformation in more or less equal parts to offend anyone except a very young child. That would have to be a very, very young child, I reminded her. But mostly what we discussed was what we called the female predicament. All sorts of children came to the island with Peter, children of every culture, every color, every faith. The only difference Peter ever recognized was gender. Boy, if you'll pardon the expression. Tiger Lily and I laid most of the blame squarely on Wendy. Perhaps that's not really fair, but she did start the whole mother business. I knew she was trouble. The second I laid eyes on her in the nursery that night, the second Peter laid eyes on her, forgot his shadow right. What galls me is that I didn't see through that one immediately, but after all, I'm a fairy. We handle things differently. It's all magic with us. I should have known, though. I'd been around Peter long enough, and even if he had lived in Never Never Land, since falling out of his pram in Kensington Gardens, he'd always be more human boy when it came right down to it. Which suggests, naturally, that even he wasn't really aware of what he was doing when he forgot his stupid shadow, and then had to go back for it. But with all the signs there, I should have been able to read them. I shouldn't have had to have gotten locked in a damn drawer before I figured out what was going on. Was I mad when he let me out? And was she surprised when she saw me? Tried to kiss up to me right away, too. Talking about how beautiful I was, and acting all enchanted to see a real live fairy and all that rot. But the look in her eyes wasn't wide, innocent wonder. Her eyes weren't quite wide enough. In fact, they were narrowed ever so slightly. It wasn't wonder there, but wariness and territoriality and jealousy. Jealous of a fairy only a few inches high? Talk about mixing information and misinformation. Right away, she started trying to one-up me. Oh, I can sew, and I can do the spring cleaning, and I'll be your mother, and blah, blah, blah. And I got sucked right into it. I can't deny that. I got pissy about the fairy dust. Okay, shame on me. But in the end, they flew, all of them, they flew away to Never Neverland, had all those adventures. Okay. The thing with the arrow was awful, too. But come on, this is Never Neverland we're talking about. I knew she couldn't actually be killed. Not killed, not killed dead. It's like a roller coaster, a great scare, but nothing permanent. I wanted to scare the living daylights out of her. I wanted to scare her so bad she could fly all the way back to the nursery just by screaming. Now I shudder to think that I could do such a thing to another female, even if it was Wendy. Do you see how crazy it made me? And in such a short period of time. Awful, just awful. But she played it for all it was worth and then some. Her great hovering on the brink of death scene. Name me someone else who got a whole house built for herself that way. So it wasn't much of a house. We all continued to live in the underground place. The symbolism was enough to seal our fates. By attacking her, I'd managed to cement her position. She had second thoughts about it after a while, when it was too late really to do anything about it. If she hadn't started the whole mother business, she'd have been treated like a lost boy with a dirty face and her own bow and arrow. She wasn't the first girl who'd made it to Never Never Land, but there hadn't been many in the past. Peter automatically gravitated to boys, though occasionally one or two of them had sisters who came along, as if caught in the backwash. Canny little things, kept a low profile, did everything the boys did, okay, obeyed Peter's orders and didn't say much. I checked on them later, and I must say it was interesting the way things turned out for them. The little Sanger girl, for instance. Looking at it from that angle, you would think that the first female to assert herself as a female rather than just one of the boys could have brought some significant changes to Never Never Land, and thence to the world. But as soon as we get one, what does she do but perpetuate the same old roles? Well, it was all she knew. Being female has never saved anyone from a limited imagination. But perhaps it might have been different if she'd been a single parent and not insisted that Peter be the father. That would have made the position of mother something altogether different. She might have come into her own as a heroic figure. But that was part of all she knew, mother and father, and from her point of view, Peter was the logical choice for father, even leaving the way she felt about him out of it. And when you consider her emotions, well, there was no one on the island to advise her that just because you love a male doesn't mean that you should have a family with him. Would she have listened if there had been? To be fair, I don't suppose I'd have wanted to be the single mother of that bunch either. But with Peter as the father, she might as well have been. Peter, the father with the roving eye, and dumb enough to talk to Wendy about it. Gosh, Wendy, I don't know what Tiger Lily wants to be to me, but I don't think it's a mother. Woo, did she give him hell about that? And poor Lil, she got sucked into the game just as I did. Peter and the boys rescued her from the pirates hundreds and hundreds of times. It was part of the great tradition that makes Never Never Land what it is. It wasn't that Peter nearly died on the rock. He always nearly died. Hooks bite the rising tide, Peter speaking what he believes will be his last words about dying being an awfully big adventure. This is fantasy childhood drama. She changed everything. I saw it at the celebration at the Indian camp later, the way she looked at Lil. It was the same way she looked at me in the nursery. Lil obviously didn't know it was happening exactly, but she reacted to Wendy the way she would have to anyone hunting on Indian land without permission. And she knew instinctively that she had to win something of Peter's heart if she ever wanted to be rescued from the pirates again. I think that was the bitterest pill for her. Up until then, winning something of Peter's heart wasn't even an issue. If Peter had even just been showing signs of growing up, impossible, of course, but just for the sake of example, she'd have let him go. But that wasn't the problem. In my more unkind moments, I've thought that was why Wendy got herself captured by the pirates. Of course, everybody got captured by the pirates. That was part of the tradition. But this time, it wasn't just Hook and his men capturing all of Peter's men. This time, Hook had Peter's family, the children, and their mother. It put a whole different spin on the rescue, especially after that little scene she played with the boys in the underground house. Another blatant attempt to force Peter's hand is what it was, telling him that story about mothers pining away for their children, reminding the boys, not the first time she told the story. I knew sooner or later Peter would listen to it, and it would get to him. Did she really, truly believe, deep down, that she would be able to pull Peter away from Never Never Land? If so, the joke was on her. She got everyone except Peter. And the looks on those boys' faces as they prepared to leave Never Never Land forever. Is it any wonder I tried to kill myself? I know, everyone thinks it's my noblest moment, saving Peter from drinking Hook's poison. But I didn't have to drink it myself to do that. Every other time, I always just flew into the room and knocked the glass from his hands. But that time, I was in despair. I felt Peter's loss even more deeply than he did. I loved those boys, too, after all. They were a big part of my life as well. The way she manipulated their feelings, playing them like blooming violins, for goodness sake. What a nightmare. I felt that was worse poison than what Hook put in Peter's medicine. Another of Wendy's little innovations, as if anyone ever got sick on the island. So I squared my shoulders, preened my wings, and said, "Goodbye, cruel world." Yes, I really would have died, sort of. As Peter has explained to countless children, real death comes for one of my kind whenever a child says, "I don't believe in fairies." The poison would have killed me as well, just because of the treatment Peter had decided on, leaving it to children everywhere all over the world to affirm their belief in fairies. Had I expired before Peter could help me, I would simply have been reborn in some other realm that allows the existence of fairies without memory, without sadness. I was hoping for something Nordic. And then Peter had to interfere. Had his treatment failed, had there been too few children clapping their hands, there would have been no rebirth for me, just nothingness. Peter felt he had to prove something to both of us, that he still had it, of course, that he was still the most beloved boy of all time, and thus children would clap their hands just because he asked them to. Some see that as Peter's noblest moment, others see it as childhood's noblest moment. The truth is, something that is probably best left unsaid in a place like Never Never Land. You can't have a Never Never Land without a certain amount of denial. You know the rest of the story. Did Hook and the pirates really die? Of course not. I found Hook later, washed up on the shore of Mermaid Lagoon with his clothes in rags, cursing a blue streak. Most of it sounded like, "Arr, arr," and vowing revenge. If a little confused, he thought he'd lost his hand to the crocodile just then. I kept an eye on him until Smee floated in, clinging to a bit of driftwood. If it were not against the rules, I would visit Smee in the middle of the night sometimes and have a few long talks with him, too. I suspect there's a lot of common ground between us, and perhaps the time is coming when I will be able to have a word or two with him. Everyone weeps over the last meeting between Wendy and Peter in London, myself included. Surprised? Me too, a little. Of course, I don't just weep over that. I weep for the lost boys, become bankers and citizens of good standing. How I miss them, Toodles and Slightly and the rest. And I weep for Wendy, too. For a realization of what she lost, which was not Peter. What she lost was much more complex than that. And then she went and did it anyway. Let her own daughter take her place to do Peter's spring cleaning. Oh, that really galled me. I'd have thought that growing up would have made her realize her mistake, and instead she visited it upon her daughter. And her daughter did the same to her daughter, Wendy's granddaughter. Except by then, things were starting to change. There's a whole new group of lost boys in Neva Neverland, of course, and Peter's memory didn't admit that there'd ever been any others, though occasionally he slipped and called one of them Toodles and was mightily confused at his mistake since he didn't remember Toodles. The name just came out of nowhere as far as he was concerned. I never reminded him. He never slipped with the girls. There would be only one Wendy, and though her memory grew dim, it never vanished completely. Odd, but there's no accounting for the vagaries of a mind like Peter's. What was even more interesting, though, was that from the time Wendy left, there was never more than one girl brought to Never Neverland, and she was always brought to fill Wendy's old position as quasi-mother. No more did little girls slip in among the gang, brought to have adventures with the pirates and the Indians, and to vow that they would never grow up, at least for a little while. There was always just the one girl. Wendy's daughter went along with it, but Wendy's granddaughter, she was a different story altogether. She wasn't completely free of the expectations that had been thrust upon her, both here in Never Neverland and back in the real world, but she questioned a lot, and if she didn't like the answers, she could be quite stubborn. One day, I found Peter and the boys making their own beds. She was off swimming in Mermaid Lagoon. Hook tried to capture her, of course, and Peter and the other boys ran to her rescue. But what do you suppose they found when they got there? Hook, running as if for his life, while she pelted him with stones and shells and driftwood and anything else she could find to throw, and yelling threats of worse punishment if he ever had the nerve to bother her again. Poor Hook. He didn't know what hit him. After all, he was a pirate. When he captured her and the boys later, his pirate band was twice the size it usually was, and to this day I have no idea where he found the extra men. Men, yes. As I said, he was a pirate. So, after they all went home to grow up, I tried to talk to Peter. Next season, I said, just round up a bunch of boys and girls and treat them all like lost boys. The whole point is to have adventures without parents, especially mothers. They'll all like that. If spring cleaning doesn't get done and the beds don't get made, so what? This is Never Never Land, for heaven's sake. But would he listen? Lost boys and a mother, that was the formula, he said. He was Peter Pan, I was just the fairy with the dust. My job was to get them off the ground, he was the one who really taught them how to fly, and he was the leader. Then he reminded me about saving my life the time I drank poison, and believe me, I bit my tongue pretty hard to keep from telling him a few hard truths about that. But then I'm pretty sure it's against the rules to use the word suicide attempt in Never Neverland. Certain amount of denial, right? So he went and he got Wendy's great-granddaughter, and that's when the dirt really hit the fan. Only Hook is allowed profanity, and he never gets worse than damn. I got away with ass just because it really is another word for donkey. Wendy's great-granddaughter got the picture the minute her feet touched down on the island. Ooh, you never saw such a fuss. Mother? I'll give you mother. I didn't fly straight on till morning to clean up after a bunch of boys. Now bring on those pirates. Where's that Hook? I'll tear him limb from limb. Where are the Indians? I want to beat the tom-tom and go on the warpath. Where's the fairy? I want to fly some more. Peter, of course, tried to argue with her. From the moment he alighted at her window to the time they took off into the night, he never once said spring cleaning or mother or anything like it. By then he was taking a lot for granted. He shouldn't have been. You know that. I know that. I think even some of the long-term boys knew that. But Peter, well, that's the perennial boy for you. Things had changed back there in the world. It didn't mean there had to be any kind of major changes in Never Never Land except for the genders of the children involved. If he'd just been able to go with that particular flow, eventually he would never have known the difference between having adventures with just all boys and having adventures with a mixed band of boys and girls. Perhaps that was too mature a viewpoint for the kind of boy he was. And perhaps an invisible line had been crossed when Wendy had played mother. The denial for the need of a mother had been erased, you see, and there was no going back. And poor Peter just couldn't readjust his perception of what a mother was. Mothers didn't fight pirates. They didn't go on the warpath with Indians. They didn't have their own bows and arrows. Ho, ho, ho. What I could have told him about that from my visits to the real world. Yes, I visited there more often after Wendy's granddaughter. I knew I had some catching up to do. And yes, I did find Wendy on one of those visits. She was a very old woman by then. I found her in Kensington Gardens, and what do you suppose she was doing? Letting children out of their prams. Yes, and only girl children. Oh, I know they don't call them prams anymore, but you know what I mean. No one really knew what she was doing, and none of the children ever got far before their mothers caught them again. She was dotty, I decided, as I lured her to a secluded area and revealed myself. "Hello, Tink," she said. "Do you still hate me?" "I never really hated you," I told her. "But you must realize that what you did wasn't right." She gave a sigh that shook her body alarmingly. "Just a bundle of sticks now, Aunt Wendy. I was glad Peter wasn't here." "Of course I understand," she said. "Why do you think I'm letting the little girls loose? They're entitled to a childhood full of adventures and excitement, not just training for an adulthood of nothing but limitations." She laughed sadly. "Yes, Tink, I've learned. That's part of growing up, you see, to learn some of your lessons too late. I'm trying to make amends, but it's hard. People watch their children so much more closely than they used to. I don't think a child's been lost to the fairies here in over 30 years. And there are so few of them. They're all shut up tight in daycare centers and schools. Peter's lucky to get any of them at all, boys or girls." She paused, looking alarmed. "Does he still get to them, Tink? Or has the worst happened?" Obviously, she hadn't seen her granddaughter lately, which made me feel very sad for her indeed. I was about to tell her all about that when a police officer came along, rendering me invisible. All she found was a dotty old woman talking to some hydrangea bushes, and she led her away, still talking. That made me feel very, very sad. Poor Wendy, a stereotype to the end. You can see it coming, can't you? Anybody can, except Peter and some of the more obtuse boys. She rebelled completely, of course. The first night in the underground house, she crept up to my chamber, took some fairy dust, and flew out into the darkness. She was back the next morning with her own band, and needless to say, they were all girls. They set up camp in Mermaid Lagoon and waited for the pirates to attack. Hook, who had been burned before and hadn't forgotten it, held off and had a few half-hearted skirmishes with Peter and his band instead. The girls got tired of waiting, and in a brilliant midnight raid, attacked the Jolly Roger and took it over, forcing all the pirates to walk the plank. They sailed around in it for weeks until they lost interest and went ashore. Hook and his men saved it from going aground, refitted it, and declared war. What excitement! What action! Sometimes the girls would win, sometimes the pirates would beat them back. But even when the pirates won, they knew they'd been in a fight, I can tell you. Hook lived in mortal fear that the lost girls and the lost boys would join forces and completely overwhelm him and his men. Do I have to tell you that that never happened? Peter and his boys had a very disappointing season. It rained every other day, and they ended up hanging around the underground house, bored out of their minds. So much so that some of the new boys started talking about something called video games and television. That was what Peter had tried to tell me. That was when Peter had tried to tell me we were doing fine, providing childhoods for those who would otherwise have been forced to unfortunate precocity. While on the other side of the island, the girls had made a treaty with the Indians and were whooping it up like mad. When it finally occurred to Peter that he hadn't seen Tiger Lily in many, many moons, his dismay was terrible to behold. And when he crept up to the Indian village and found Wendy's granddaughter and Tiger Lily smoking a peace pipe together and leading the dance around the campfire without him, I thought he would die of heartbreak. He could not get over that one, of course, and it was what drove him to ask her for a meeting. I carried the message to her naturally. "Well, well," she said to me, "so as Nibs has finally decided to parley, eh? What do you say, girls? Shall I talk with our boy Pan, or shall we attack the pirates again?" They all voted for the pirates, but she was just being difficult. She agreed to meet him in Mermaid Lagoon. It didn't go well. Peter swaggered up to her and said brightly, "Well, time to go home and grow up. The boys are ready. How about you?" She poked him in the chest with her finger. "You can keep that stuff, pal. Not all the boys go home and grow up. You don't go home and grow up, so who says we have to? Maybe some of my girls want to, and if they do, I won't stop them. But me, I like it here. I'm planning to stay a good long time, maybe forever and ever. I like showing Hook who's boss. I like dancing around the campfire with Tiger Lily and the rest of the Indians. And I like flying." Peter gave me a dirty look. He knew I'd been supplying her as well as him. "But what could I do? If you're a child in Never Never Land, you get the dust. It's the law." "The pirates could have it if they wanted, but it won't work for them because they can't think good thoughts. And the Indians have their own way of life." They argued and argued, but Peter couldn't get her to budge. In the end, some of the boys left, but not one of the girls. And when Peter went out to collect some more children the next season, he couldn't find one girl to be mother. They'd all gone with her. She stayed and stayed and stayed until it was obvious that she was never going to leave the island. No one knew what to call her. Pammy Pam? Patty Pam? Petra Pam? She settled on Elspeth. Heaven knows why, I don't. And for a long, long time, it was the Lost Boys with Peter and Lost Girls with Elspeth, and never the twain would meet. And then, of course, it happened. The morning dawned when there were both girls and boys with Elspeth, and only boys with Peter. "Nothing I could do, Tink," Elspeth told me. "I've been taking their sisters away for years, and the sisters had been telling them stories, and they wanted in on the fun. Sure, I said no at first. Then I realized how unfair it was. After all, Peter's been doing just that very thing with the girls. That's how I got started in the first place. It's ridiculous to have the boys only with boys and girls only with girls. It's not how anyone lives. Oh, the pirates are all male, but they're pirates. You don't expect pirates to be enlightened." I had a feeling the pirates' day was coming. But they weren't my concern. They could take care of themselves. "Couldn't you just combine the bands," I said, "lost girls and lost boys together?" "Only if I or one of the other girls will be the mother," Elspeth said grimly. "And we won't do it. We won't. If Peter can be stubborn, we can be just as stubborn." And there it sits. Peter on one side of the island with his little band, and Elspeth on her side with her somewhat larger band. What's really sad is that Peter's band gets smaller every year. Going with Elspeth has so much more to offer. She gets all the good fights with the pirates and all the good parties with the Indians, and she's even usurped Peter's drowning scene on the rock. Peter mopes around and cuts himself whittling a lot. Occasionally, a boy goes over to Elspeth, and then it rains for a week on Peter's side. I guess what it is really is that eternal childhood is, well, not a lie exactly, but a half-truth. At some point, perhaps the very point at which a child is ready for Never Never Land, childhood is actually more of a choice than a condition. Elspeth chose. Peter could choose, too, but so far he won't. I think because he's so afraid that doing such a thing will mean he's growing up, and it won't mean any such thing at all. And there's the whole difference between childhood and childish. I shouldn't try to be an expert, because I am, after all, a fairy. And as I said, it's all magic with fairies. Magic and no worries, unless you drink poison. And believe me, I'm not stupid enough to try that twice. Not the way things are today. Sometimes I wonder, though, what would happen. If my life depended on somebody's faith, whose faith would save me? Is Peter still strong enough? Does he still believe all those little children out there in the dark believe? After all that's happened, I like to think that's still so. I like to think that that's what keeps Peter the eternal boy he is, and that someday he'll go over to the upper side of the island and hail Elspeth as his ally and friend, forget this silly mother business once and for all. It's not like he's got anything to lose. And then he'll really be himself again. He'll go back to being brave Peter Pan, the boy who won't grow up, instead of poor Peter, the boy that the children hardly ever fly with anymore. Thank you.
We'll need lots of wood, need lots of leaves, need lots of paint.
Come in.
Get up, Mike. Hush. Let's be quiet as a mouse and build a lovely little house for Wendy. All for Wendy. She's come to stay.
And meet our mother, alas, we have a mother.
Home sweet home upon the wall, a welcome mat down in the hall for Wendy. So that Wendy won't go away.
We have a mother, alas, we have a mother.
Oh, what pleasure she'll bring to us, make us pockets, and sing to us, tell us stories we've been longing to hear. Over and over, she'll be waiting at the door. We won't be lonely anymore since Wendy, lovely Wendy's here to stay.
You've been listening to The Lost Girls, read for you by the author Pat Cadigan, here on Hour of the Wolf over WBAI, New York, and WBAI.org.
Alas, we have a mother. We have a mother. Alas, we have a mother.
Oh, what pleasure she'll bring to us, make us pockets, and sing to us, tell us stories we've been longing to hear. Over and over, she'll be waiting at the door. We won't be lonely anymore since Wendy, lovely Wendy's here to stay.
We have a mother, alas, we have a mother.
She'll be our mother. It's nice to have a mother. Wendy's here to stay.
Chapter 18 of The Little White Bird by J.M. Barrie, Peter's Goat. I hope you have had a good night, he said earnestly. Oh, thank you, she replied. I was so cozy and warm. But you, she looked at his nakedness awkwardly, don't you feel the least bit cold? Now, cold was another word Peter had forgotten. So I answered, I think not, but I may be wrong. You see, I'm rather ignorant. I'm not exactly a boy. Solomon says I am a betwixt and between. So that is what it is called, said Mamie thoughtfully. Well, that's not my name, he explained. My name is Peter Pan. Yes, of course, she said. I know, everybody knows. You can't think how pleased Peter was to learn that all the people outside the gates knew about him. He begged Mamie to tell him what they knew and what they said, and she did so. They were sitting by this time on a fallen tree. Peter had cleared off the snow for Mamie, but he sat on a snowy bit himself. Squeeze closer, Mamie said. What is that? He asked, and she showed him, and then he did it. They talked together, and he found that people knew a great deal about him, but not everything. Not that he had gone back to his mother and been barred out, for instance, and he said nothing of this to Mamie, for it still humiliated him. "Do they know that I play games exactly like real boys?" he asked very proudly. "Oh, Mamie, please tell them." But when he revealed how he played, by sailing his hoop on the round pond and so forth, she was simply horrified. "All your ways of playing," she said with her big eyes on him, "are quite wrong, not in the least like how boys play." Poor Peter uttered a little moan at this, and he cried for the first time for I know not how long. Mamie was extremely sorry for him and lent him her handkerchief, but he didn't know in the least what to do with it, so she showed him. That is to say, she wiped her eyes and then gave it back to him, saying, "Now you do it." But instead of wiping his own eyes, he wiped hers, and she thought it best to pretend that this is what she had meant. She said, out of pity for him, "I shall give you a kiss if you like." But though he once knew, he had long forgotten what kisses are, and he replied, "Thank you," and held out his hand, thinking that she had offered to put something into it. This was a great shock to her, but she felt she could not explain it without shaming him. So with charming delicacy, she gave Peter a thimble, which happened to be in her pocket, and pretended that it was a kiss. Poor little boy, he quite believed her, and to this day he wears it on his finger, though there can be scarcely anyone who needs a thimble so little. You see, though still a tiny child, it was really years and years since he had seen his mother, and I dare say the baby who had supplanted him was now a man with whiskers. But you must not think that Peter Pan was a boy to pity rather than to admire. If Mamie began by thinking this, she soon found out she was very much mistaken. Her eyes glistened with admiration when he told her of his adventures, especially of how he went to and fro between the island and the gardens. in the thrush's nest.
Can you hear? It's the wind of change blowing. Hear the sigh of a tree. A tree sighs for its growing. Hold me fast in the night, for the night brings the knowing of the place we've come from and the place where we're going. Lullaby, lullaby, take the breath that you long for. When you dream, time stands still, and I'll sing you one song more of a land in between, between this and the other, where the rain's white as milk, and the moon is your mother.
Jane's child now, who waves from the window, enthralled to the breath of the night sky, where her child is flying, gay and innocent and heartless.
What is it, dear, dear Peter? Mamie said, wondering. Oh, Mamie, he cried. It isn't fair to take you with me if you think you can go back. Your mother, he gulped again. You don't know them as well as I do. He told her the woeful story of how he had been barred out, and she gasped all the time. But my mother, she said. My mother. Yes, she would, said Peter. They are all the same. I dare say she is looking for another one already. Mamie said aghast, I can't believe it. You see, when you went away, your mother had none, but my mother is Tony, and surely they are satisfied when they have won. Peter replied bitterly, you should see the letters Solomon gets from ladies who have six. Just then they heard a grating creak, followed by creak, creak, all around the gardens. It was the opening of the gates, and Peter jumped nervously into his boat. He knew Mamie would not come with him now, and he was trying bravely not to cry, but Mamie was sobbing painfully. "If I should be late," she called in agony, "oh, Peter, she has another one already!" Again he sprang ashore as if she had called him back. "I shall come and look for you tonight," he said, squeezing close, "but if you hurry away, I think you will be in time." Then he pressed the last thimble on her sweet little mouth and covered his face with his hands so that he might not see her go. "Dear Peter," she cried. "Dear Mamie," cried the tragic boy. She leapt into his arms so that it was kind of a fairy wedding, and then she hurried away. Oh, how she hastened to the gates. Peter, you may be sure, was back in the gardens that night as soon as lockout sounded, but he found no Mamie, and so he knew she had been in time. For long he hoped that some night she would come back to him. Often he thought he would see her waiting for him by the shore of the Serpentine as his bark drew to land, but Mamie never went back. She wanted to, but she was afraid that if she saw her dear betwixt and between again, she would linger with him too long, and besides, the Aya now kept a sharp eye on her. But she talked lovingly of Peter, and she knitted a kettle holder for him, and one day when she was wondering what Easter present he would like, her mother made a suggestion. Nothing, she said thoughtfully, would be so useful to him as a goat. He could ride on it, cried Mamie, and play on his pipe at the same time. Then her mother asked, won't you give him your goat, the one you frightened Tony with at night? But it isn't a real goat, Mamie said. It seems real to Tony, replied her mother. It seems frightfully real to me, too, Mamie said. But how could I give it to Peter? Her mother knew a way, and next day, accompanied by Tony, who's really quite a nice boy, of course, although he could not compare, they went to the gardens, and Mamie stood alone within a fairy ring. And then her mother, who's a rather gifted lady, said, my daughter, tell me if you can, what have you got for Peter Pan? To which Mamie replied, I have a goat for him to ride. Observe me cast it far and wide. She then flung her arms about as if she were sowing seed and turned round three times. Next Tony said, if P doth find it waiting here, wilt ne'er again make me to fear? And Mamie answered, by light or dark, I fondly swear never to see goats anywhere. Well, this is as far as I will go, but I will give you the closing. Of this chapter of The Little White Bird by J.M. Barrie. Though Peter still remembers Mamie, he has become as gay as ever, and often in sheer happiness he jumps off his goat and lies kicking merrily on the grass. Oh, he has a joyful time, but he still has a vague memory that he was a human once, and it makes him especially kind to the house swallows when they revisit the island, for house swallows are the spirits of little children who have died. They always build in the eaves of the houses where they lived when they were humans, and sometimes they try to fly in at a nursery window, and perhaps that is why Peter loves them best of all the birds. And the little house? Every lawful night, that is to say, every night except ball nights, the fairies now build the little house lest there be a human child lost in the gardens, and Peter rides the marshes looking for the lost ones. And if he finds them, he carries them on his goat to the little house, and when they wake up, they are in it, and when they step out, they see it. The fairies built the house merely because it is so pretty. But Peter rides round in memory of Mamie, and because he still loves to do so, just as he believes real boys would do. But you must not think that, because somewhere among the trees the little house is twinkling, it is a safe thing to remain in the gardens after lockout time. If the bad ones among the fairies happen to be out that night, they will certainly mischief you, and even though they are not, you may perish of cold and dark before Peter Pan comes around. He has been too late several times. When he sees he is too late, he runs back to the thrush's nest for his paddle, of which Mamie had told him the true use, and he digs a grave for the child, and erects a little tombstone, and carves the poor thing's initials on it. He does this at once, because he thinks this is what real boys would do, and you must have noticed the little stones, that there are always two together. He puts them in twos, because it seems less lonely. I think that quite the most touching sight in the gardens are the two tombstones of Walter Stephen Matthews and Phoebe Phelps. They stand together at the spot where the parishes of Westminster St. Mary's is said to meet the parish of Paddington. Here Peter found the two babes who had fallen unnoticed from their perambulators. Phoebe aged 13 months, Walter probably still younger, for Peter seems to have felt a delicacy about putting any age on his stone. David sometimes places white flowers on these two innocent graves. But how strange for parents when they hurry into the gardens at the opening of the gates looking for their lost one to find the sweetest little tombstone instead. I do hope that Peter is not too ready with his spade. It is all rather sad. Well, that was chapter 18, Peter's Goat, from the novel The Little White Bird, 1902, by J.M. Barrie. 109 years old, that novel. And the introduction of Peter Pan. And you can see, I hope, from hearing that, well, slightly mangled, but nevertheless faithful excerpt, that this is not a kid's book, okay? If you thought that was strange, well, it gets stranger, and it helps, you know, Peter's being betwixt and between is referring to his humanity. He's part bird, part human, part sprite, part fairy. Peter Pan is a complicated character, and like many characters of fairy and fantasy throughout the years, one whose needs, whose character has changed to fit the needs, whether they are the brilliance of reminding us of the work of J.M. Barrie through the Mabu Mines, or the commercialism and not bad animation of the Disney Corporation in the 1950s, or just the fun of Mary Martin and those who have followed in her fly steps. And by the way, no spider people were killed in the making, or harmed in the making of Peter Pan. So there is currently Peter and the Starcatcher running off-Broadway, and coming up in April, Peter and Wendy, a revival of just this amazing show that I've seen twice and I have to buy tickets for again. Maybe I can get free tickets, radio personality and all that, and I do intend to interview somebody involved in the show. But this will be the third time I'm seeing it. I don't care if I pay or not. Being that it's at the New Victory Theater, which is a theater largely for family or young people to attend. I don't know if their prices are subsidized or whatever, but they tend to be reasonable. I have to look into that for myself, if nothing else, and I better move soon, because I've talked this up to so many people within science fiction fandom and all that for so many years, and been looking for it to be revived, that, well, I may be the last one to get tickets, and I hope they're not sold out. But you've heard some of the music from it by Johnny Cunningham. It is I mean, what's not to like? Great puppetry, onstage effects and animations, this incredible performance by Karen Candle, and wonderful Celtic music with the work and the words, not an adaptation, but the words of J.M. Barrie in Peter and Wendy. So I really, really, if any of what we have done since 1:30 has intrigued you, I highly recommend this. It is now 2:48 here in New York City, so we have like 6 minutes or so. If you would like to call up and discuss such issues of fantasy, science fiction, and particularly Peter Pan, the telephone number here is area code 212-209-2900, as we wait for Lister to come in. There he is, with Burn Baby Burn clappers. So, looking cheerful and as sprightly as Peter in his way, although not as much of Peter, I don't think, has usually had that beard and mustache, although I have seen Peter with dreadlocks. There's a very interesting multicultural aspect to this Peter Pan thing. I will have to show you some of the pictures. Every form of puppetry, from marionettes to whatever. And that woman in the center, Karen Candle, she does all the acting, all the voices. No. For over 90 minutes, she commands that stage. It is an amazing performance, And as I say, if it were eligible for a Tony, it's not, because it's a limited run. At least that was the excuse the last time. But she wouldn't just be nominated, she'd win. It's an amazing performance. All the voices she does, for all of this stuff going on stage, basically one person performance. You know, not, I mean, the puppeteers count. Of course, there's, you know, 17 people on stage, but she's the one with the voice, and she's the one who is giving them voice to the lives that the puppeteers are creating, and she is the humans, a lot of the humans. She is Wendy, she is Mr. Darling, she acts them out. Captain Hook is a one kind of puppet, Peter, a different kind of puppet. It's just a fascinating, beautiful bit of stagecraft.
And the Tony, it doesn't deserve a mention at the Tony?
Well, no, because it's a limited run. Mm-hmm. The Tony Awards are for shows that open and are an open run. They are more commercial productions, and to compete in the Tony Awards, to be eligible, you can't be a limited run that opens one day and has a finite closing. It has to be a continuous thing. It has to be within Broadway, which this show is. It's on 42nd Street. It has to be in a particular kind of theater, which this show is. But it also has to be an open-ended run. We already know what date this show is closing, so it's not eligible.
I see. So it's a capitalist thing.
It's an artistic thing. When you look at the history of the Tony Awards, there is actually a rationale, albeit possibly one that needs rethinking. There's a lot about the Tony Awards that needs rethinking. But their problem is, if you open it up to something like that, then these stage shows that they do, say, at Madison Square Garden, based on, you know, Christmas Carol with, gaudy recorded music and all that, then if you let this in, then you're letting those in.
That's the guy in the subway.
Which one?
He comes on and he says, you know, ding dong, watch the closing doors, watch the closing doors. And, you know, he's like a comedian, you know, one act.
Oh, okay.
Changes into different personalities.
No, I haven't seen my Take the Bus into Manhattan. So.
You're right, it would be a slippery slope.
Yes, and that's a lot of it. So limited runs that, you know, just take advantage of a season, that was the original thinking. But then how do you word that? How do you make a rule? That's exactly it. It's a slippery slope. The Tonys have tried to open up many times. They've tried to include Off-Broadway, but a lot of the people involved in the OBEs, the Off-Broadway Awards, don't want the Tonys in their... It's complicated. Yeah. It's complicated.
So Taylor died, right?
Yes. Liz is gone. David Rothenberg's former companion.
Did she do any science fiction films?
Well, she did the Flintstones. Does that count?
It's close enough.
Yeah, it's fantasy anyway, and she was actually very good in that.
Just a stone throw away.
Yeah, well, yeah, it really is. It really is. If you have that wide lasso that I use, it's certainly in there. It's certainly in there. She played Fred's mother-in-law.
Right.
Yeah, and she was actually a lot of fun in that role. She had a good deal of humor. But she certainly lived the life of a fantastic...
Why is it they keep saying that she had seven husbands when she had a working-class eighth husband or something?
Well, she had... she was married eight times,
right.
But she married Richard Burton twice.
Oh, so it would be...
So, she... So, no, she had eight weddings to seven men.
Oh, so who was the last one, the working-class?
Yeah, I don't know about working class. He was some guy with a mullet. I mean, she met him at Michael Jackson's house or something like that. So I don't know how working class he was.
He was a plumber, right?
Well, I don't know. I never met the guy. I never spoke. And I wasn't a big Liz follower.
Was he a stagehand?
I couldn't say. He was a strange dude, apparently. But many of her husbands were. I mean, the first one, Conrad Hilton, Jr. But was certainly strange. I mean,
you know who was weird? The senator guy that she married.
Wow. Yeah. Oh yes.
That was like.
Yeah, and he was conservative Republican, and she was very active in Democrat and liberal causes. The two of them did not see eye to eye on a lot of stuff. You know, and I mean, it gets all complicated. She married, you know, the best man at her wedding when her husband died, even though he was in a fairy tale marriage with Debbie Reynolds.
That's cool.
Well, he was married, you know, and so she, you know, he was married to Debbie Reynolds. It was this big, big deal, the marriage of the century and all that. And then when her husband was tragically killed, he went over to console her and never came back. So, how cool is that? He had kids and all that. One of them grew up to be Princess Leia. Carrie Fisher. Eddie Fisher's daughter.
Yeah.
Want to talk about science fiction? That comes close enough.
Yeah. I just think that marriage is not to the advantage of a woman. You know, so, that's where I'm coming from.
Well, it depends. And what happens when that woman is a superstar with all the advantages, but David Rothenberg knew her very well.
I noticed.
He you know, he has a picture out there of her and him that's been up there for a number of years. So I would expect to hear something on his show about her this coming Saturday morning. What time does he come on now? 8?
Yeah, the same regular time on a Saturday.
Well, it used to be 8:30, but that schedule changed, which is how I came to be here.
I like that.
And it's been fun, I must say. But, you know, well, who... well, I'm already... Yeah.
That's okay. How was Robert
Knight
this morning? I ran into him.
He was great. Yeah. He was wonderful. Yeah, he did a good free-form show, which is what... yeah, so do I. It's really what I think we're all, you know, here to be doing.
It's so seamless from Robert Knight to you, to me.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun. It's I mean, when I was doing the 5 to 7 a.m. thing, it was live radio, but it wasn't freeform. That's something that I used to do many years ago. And of course, many years ago, I used to have a midnight to 5 slot. I was on Wednesday night, Thursday mornings from midnight till 5.
You're accustomed to this.
Well, yeah, except that midnight to 5 is a longer, you know, a very different stretch. But yeah, I'm accustomed. I've been in this hour before. I may also point out that was the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s when I was doing that. So it's been a little while.
Was it more fun then than now? Or
it was different. It was very different. And I was in such a different place. And Hour of the Wolf had become sort of its own formatted kind of thing within its own space. And this one, I'm still learning this space. I'm still learning this time. And I'm trying to recapture that thing that Fass has mastered through so many years, that concept, and Robert as well, of just, you know, let the flow. But then I have recordings, I have things like the reading we heard today.
I like that, which brings me to the next point. I can't wait for B.I. to have 5 channels so that, you know, we could hear more of your archives and stuff.
Well, I mean, the archives are available, and I am building a podcast.
Good.
I am doing that. But that's a long haul, and I have to learn a lot of the programming. Well, I should start outroing, and I'm going to start. I was playing the music silently underneath. I'm going to start it again.
You can take more time.
Well, thank you.
It's
you see, it is seamless. You know where it's not seamless, and this is the problem. It's
six.
Well, there's seemingly so. No, it's it's on the internet. That's the problem, is that listeners who click on the archive for Hour of the Wolf, because I segued with Robert, will hear about 2 minutes of Robert, which is fine.
That's cool.
But it just comes in the middle without any explanation. And then, for example, it will cut off in 1 minute and 10 seconds from now, right in the middle of an outro or something.
Right.
So while it's seamless for the radio, which is, after all, what we're about the flow of vibrating 99.5 million times every second in a frequency modulation. That's what 99.5 FM means, folks. By vibrating that quickly and that fast, we are creating our own event and our own flow. Unfortunately, the digital aspect of the internet and the archive doesn't allow for that. It starts at 1:30, it ends at 3.
That's ridiculous.
It's, well, you know, the only other way, you'd have to have 2 full-time employees to maintain it otherwise. There's the problem. There's the problem. And what we have is in the form of, as far as I know, unpaid, Michael Horowitz, who does all of the archive building, the programming, and all that. He does this all by himself.
You kidding?
No. So if we were to change that in any way, we would be demanding that not only he program the website, not only he come up with the archives and how they work, right, but we'd also be demanding that he listen to the air and start and stop the late night programs. You see, it can't happen. It can't happen. So therein lies the problem. I have a solution to it, though, that I've talked to management briefly about. It involves volunteers, so that they can do our stupid copyright confessor stuff. And
interns like the White House, right?
How about interns like WBAI? Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we're a nonprofit educational institution. They get school credit for doing it.
Really?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Because we are a California-based educational institution, part of the Pacifica Foundation. That actually has a meaning.
Yes.
That a lot of people forget. So we can actually, we are an educational organization, legally. So we can give school credit.
Yes.
For people who work here. And that's something we have to start doing again. I think they still do it in the journalism parts of WBAI.
Right.
But we have to start doing this in the more administrative parts.
It will catch up.
I hope so. We need it. Let me thank you. I'm already into your airtime by a minute and a half.
Well, you made the point.
Well, okay. Yes, exactly. So, let me tell people that this may now be Burn Baby Burn Clappers, and stay tuned for Lister and his amazing music. But this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I'll be back next week on Wednesday night, Thursday morning, from 1:30 to 3 a.m. If you'd like to know more, visit my outdated but still informative website at ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, and also learn more about the next reading that we're holding at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings on April 5th with Lev Grossman and Barbara Krasnoff. So, again, thank you for listening. Visit the website. Write me an email there. But stay tuned to WBAI and enjoy yourselves. Have a great week. Hopefully the weather will clear up eventually. This is Steel I Span. Thank you.
Revolutionary War is a necessary road to real liberation. Could we really win?
Oh, tell you to do it. see. Oh, hold on, Marcus, hold on. Prophecy fulfilled. Thank you.
Rubber dub style on the dance floor in the news.